It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today we're looking back at some of our favorite author interviews from 2014. Tomorrow and Tomorrow is a science fiction novel set in Pittsburgh, or rather a full-scale computer simulation of Pittsburgh, created in the aftermath of a terrorist attack that has destroyed the city. The book came out this summer and received good early reviews. By the time the following segment aired, the movie rights had been optioned by Sony Pictures. An auspicious start to the literary career of cyberpunk author Thomas Sweterlich, a longtime Pittsburgher. WESA Morning Edition host Josh Rollerson started by asking Thomas when he started writing stories.
I started writing when I was 7. That's my earliest notebook I still have. I remember very clearly writing stories about G.I. Joe. I think I was obsessed with the movie Red Dawn. So all my stories were G.I. Joe, Red Dawn mashups. So it's kind of fun for me to go back because my mom had saved all these notebooks that I filled up over the years, and they were, you know, just full of little horror stories that I was writing when I was 9 and 10 years old.
So when did this project begin?
Tomorrow and Tomorrow started a few years ago. I had been writing all my life and just doing projects that I assumed no one would read. I was very just content working on my own things. And at one point, I had just finished a novel that I had put in the drawer and was thinking of what to do next. My wife suggested I start writing some short stories because I'd been writing poetry for years, and just to really have some fun with storytelling. So I did, and I wrote a story called The City That Lies Within about a destroyed Pittsburgh and a person who is reliving his memories basically through an interactive map of the city. And that is the short story that eventually came to become this novel.
All right. Well, let's talk about it. Obviously, we want people to read the book, but can you give us a little plot outline?
Yeah. So Tomorrow and Tomorrow is set 10 years after a devastating nuclear terrorist attack has destroyed Pittsburgh. And the main character is named John Dominic Blaxton, and he survived the blast, but his wife and unborn child perished in the attack. And what he's able to do is visit the city of Pittsburgh through a fully immersive, interactive digital reconstruction of the city called the Archive. And he can relive his memories with his wife, relive walking down favorite streets, going into restaurants, seeing faces of people he knew. As his day job, he sort of works for a group that does insurance claims, and insurance companies contest death so they don't have to do payoffs, and he researches every claim, and through that research he uncovers suspicious circumstances around the death of a young woman, and that sort of propels him into this mystery.
And the story kind of takes off from there.
That's right.
There's this cliche about Pittsburghers giving directions by referring to non-existent landmarks and like the things that aren't there anymore.
That's right.
Thing,
right? That's right. So that's, his entire life is referring to things that are no longer there anymore.
So you've got a complete, total simulation of Pittsburgh as it exists, I suppose, in a period of some years leading up to when this attack happens and everything's wiped out.
That's right. So in the book, it's basically the city archive is comprised of digital images, movies, things like Google Street View just compiled together. So there is you actually could, for instance, visit different times if you wanted to. That exists within the rules of this city. The book itself is set in 2058, but a lot of the descriptions of Pittsburgh are kind of our present-day Pittsburgh. I want it to be very recognizable to people living here now.
And it's done very artfully where you, in this very science fiction way, you're never sat down and told, okay, this is how it worked. You got security camera footage and street view and all this stuff has been cobbled together. You sort of figure it out as you go along. So you're not burdened with all the exposition, but it does make sense if you take the time to think it through.
Yeah. Thanks. I'm glad you picked up on that. Yeah, that's the you're a science fiction guy, so the info dump. That's what I really try to avoid whenever I'm writing, which is basically a paragraph of exposition explaining what the world is. I thought I would trust the reader, just throw them in, hoping that they would figure out the rules of this place as we went along through references I put in there, just little descriptions, things like that. I think it can be a little bit tough sledding at the beginning, but as soon as you sink into it, I think it all clicks into place and you figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. I was inspired by A Clockwork Orange for that, the Burgess novel, because that's all written in his NADSAT language. And
right.
The first few pages, it's like reading a foreign language, but as soon as you catch up on the language they're speaking, you're very clearly understanding things. So my book is nowhere near that level, but that's, you know, sort of the standard I think I set for science fiction books. Yeah. No info dumps.
The other work that comes to mind that does a lot of those kind of neologisms and just expects you to keep up and eventually your brain kind of calibrates to the language of the text is Neuromancer.
Yes.
By Gibson, which is 30 years old this year, so it's kind of a timely anniversary.
This month, 30 this year month. Olds in July. Yeah.
Exactly. People that have read that book are going to notice a lot of really intriguing parallels. And if you enjoyed Neuromancer, you're probably going to enjoy this book.
Yeah, well, let's pick up on Gibson. I think there's a good parallel for what I was trying to do. So cyberpunk fiction, it's sort of a type of science fiction writing. There's two works that people think of when they think of cyberpunk. One is Neuromancer by Gibson, and one is the movie Blade Runner that came out just a couple years before Neuromancer did. And my book is very much in that tradition, but there's another movie that I kind of look to in terms of how to write my book, and that's Children of Men, which came out just a few mm-hmm. years ago. The director of Children of Men had described his movie as sort of an anti-Blade Runner because instead of hyper-inventiveness in terms of creating a future that was urban but essentially very futuristic, he wanted references in his movie. So when you watch Children of Men, you're very rooted in the real world of England, and there's a lot of references to the political atmosphere of our time here, even though that movie's set in the future. So that's what I wanted to go for with my book. So as indebted I am to William Gibson, I was really thinking of how to write sort of a William Gibson novel, but channeled through this idea of referencing the real world instead of pure invention. So Neuromancer, you know, I had the choice to choose publishers. I went with Putnam because that's where William Gibson publishes. So he's an absolute hero of mine in terms of science fiction writing. And very, very dense language, very poetic. In fact, William Gibson's Neuromancer was one of the books that sort of turned me on to science fiction coming from a poetry background through college and my writing through my early 20s. I really found in that book just the everything I liked about poetry, but it was set in such a fresh way that seemed very relevant to my life, you know, as I, you know, try to grapple with this kind of new digital world we're living in that he had, you know, preceded by decades, yeah. You know, imagining. So, that book is very important to me.
And like Neuromancer, this is very much in the category of literary science fiction, literary in the sense that there is that emphasis on the style and the language and the sort of formal innovations. Also literary in a sort of referential way. There are a lot of references to and quotes from and epigraphs from works of literature. The title alludes to Macbeth.
Yeah. Well, the title, to start there and kind of work backwards, the title was interesting because the manuscript when I was talking with my agent was, you know, The City That Lies Within. So the sort of short story title, which was kind of cool, sort of a Twilight Zone vibe, but, you know, not very saleable. And so we were coming up with a list of titles that we might use for the book. And so I was combing through the text, trying to find references and, you know, to pull out titles. So there's a lot of William Blake talk in the book. There's a lot of Emily Dickinson references. But there's also a Robert Frost reference, a poem of his called Out, Out, which in itself is a reference to the this Macbeth speech. And so right. When I was looking at the Macbeth speech, I realized that, you know, this is the king who had just lost his wife and talks about life as a waking shadow. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's my book. That's what this book is about. So the only drawback is that there is a novel from the mid-90s by Charles Sheffield called Tomorrow and Tomorrow. It's a science fiction novel, so...
But this one's better. Sure.
All right, yeah. So yeah, sharing the title has been kind of interesting, especially when Google's
oh, yes.
You know? But
writers have to think about SEO now. That's a new thing.
That's right. That's right. The other reference that came later is the epigraph to the entire book. It's an Emily Dickinson poem, and the sort of spirit of Emily Dickinson infuses this book in terms of one of the characters. And so as I was looking through her poetry, I found this one in particular that talks about the sort of altered mindset that she feels during grief. And it was, you know, reading this poem, I thought, oh, she could be describing this notion of the archive. And so I put that in there to begin the book with, and I think it's like a perfect summary of what I was going after. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of allusions throughout the text.
You're listening to Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Josh Rawlerson, talking about Tomorrow and Tomorrow, a new novel by Pittsburgh resident Thomas Sweterlich. Let's talk about some of the other influences on this novel, and specifically the Pittsburgh ones. The other thing that this calls to mind to me is sort of early Michael Chabon with very specific place references. I know there are other writers that have done that have Pittsburgh connections, but you seem to have taken a lot of trouble to be very precise about putting the reader in a particular neighborhood or a particular restaurant or an intersection.
Yeah, I was thinking a lot of maps. There was something I read once about Joyce's Ulysses where someone was mapping out the journeys of the characters and thought like, oh, this could be a map of Dublin. You could follow street to street and go to these places.
And you can, I think.
And you can. And I thought, you know, my book isn't going to be quite to that depth of Ulysses, but I wanted something similar. I just find that, you know, very, very interesting when I'm reading novels, that sort of sense of place. So, yeah, the Pittsburgh scenes are two very specific details grounded in Pittsburgh. Stores you'll recognize, things that, you know, if you've walked down certain streets in Shadyside, you'll recognize. I have real band names on posters and T-shirts and
I think WYEP gets a mention in there.
WYEP does. That's right.
WESA does not.
Well, WESA, I don't know if that really existed
yet.
I don't think you existed yet. So we'll have to go to the future archive. But yeah, the Summer Music Festival, a scene happens there. Yeah, so I was very, very, very much interested in describing Pittsburgh like that. And so so he's interacting with Pittsburgh digitally, and in the real world, quote unquote, he's in other cities. So the start of the book, he's in Washington, D.C., and I know that city very well. And so I picked very real places in D.C. that he was at. And about halfway through the novel, I decided I wanted to pick a city that I didn't know so that I could interact with that city digitally, just like characters in the book have been interacting with the archive, to see if I could create some effect through that. So I chose San Francisco primarily because that's where Vertigo is set, Hitchcock's movie, and that was a sort of another influence on the characters in this book. And so I set all the scenes in San Francisco strictly through Google Street View and walking the streets, driving, you know, quote unquote, driving my car through the streets, finding these different places. And I don't think it created any special effects from it. I've had people that live in San Francisco just question when I'd been out there. So it worked in terms of realism, but yeah, that was a sort of experiment.
So they bought it.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting to me for that in particular, but I don't know what I was hoping for, some sort of, you know, funhouse version of a city that wouldn't quite line up with reality, but I think it just actually just does.
The other reason that the Pittsburgh setting potentially may be of note is that this has been optioned for a movie, and if and when it comes around, I'm guessing this will be – at least some of the production is going to happen in – what are they calling it? Hollywood East now?
That's right, Hollywood East. That would be the hope. Yeah, so my agent is David Gernert of the Gernert Company, and it's part of his selling of the book. He – you know, that company basically tries to sell movie options for everything, and in my case, it happened. And it was actually really – really kind of cool. I was working at the library at the time, working the front desk, and I, despite this book being essentially, you know, Facebook and smartphones wired into your brain, I didn't own a cell phone until just a few months after I'd sold the book for the first time. And so I was sitting at the library, my cell phone goes off, I see it's my agent, and it was a very slow afternoon. I picked it up, and I found someone to cover the desk for me, and he said, "Tom, I need to tell you something that's happening right now." And I was like, okay, what's happening right now? And he said, yeah, a studio had made an offer on the book, and we had to decide what we were going to do with it in an hour. And so during that hour, the agent was, you know, going back and forth to different studios who were interested. And I eventually got a phone call saying that Sony Pictures had won for the option. And I was ecstatic. I didn't know exactly what that meant.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So they have there's a lot of people involved, and basically buying the option is essentially buying dibs to make the movie. It doesn't mean they're making the movie. So there's, you know, probably low chance that they'll actually make this movie, but there's a screenwriter working on it. Noah Oppenheim, I believe his name is. He just wrote the screenplay for a movie called The Maze Runner that just came out. And it was really, really fun. I talked to the producers at Sony on the phone just to introduce myself and, kind of talk to each other. And I told them how excited I was that the Matt Damon movie Elysium was coming out that weekend. Because I'm a huge fan of that director from District 9, and I was really looking forward to it. And I said, so, good luck. Whoever's involved in that, good luck. And the person I was talking to said, like, oh, that's my movie. Thanks. So that was sort of a jaw-dropping moment. But, then I just went back to my normal life.
So normal life for you now is full-time writing. You quit your day job, and this is your now.
Yeah, this is my – I don't know how long it's going to last. I'm just enjoying it right now. I was lucky enough to have a two-book deal as part of this. So I have a second novel I've been feverishly working on that's due fairly soon, actually. So, my full-time is just spending hours and hours on this second novel and trying to, create something with that too.
You talk about the new one?
Yeah, it was funny during the sale of this first one, my agent asked, like, oh, what do you have next? Like, we can talk about that. And my brother-in-law, a man named Pete O'Connor, is an NCIS agent. And one day over burgers at a Five Guys at the Tyson's Corner Mall in near D.C., I told him, I said, like, oh, I think I'd like to write about an NCIS agent who time travels. I'd never done a time travel book before. And he said, actually what would be helpful with time travel is that most murder cases they investigate, are solved fairly quickly because of eyewitnesses or, the person that did it is, it's a tragic situation where they know each other. But sometimes the witnesses aren't talking and you just get kind of stuck. And he said, it'd be great if you could go into the future where you could make that as a cold case so all the relationships have changed, find out the true story, come back to the present and prosecute the case. And so I thought, I was like, that is a great idea. That's, because in my books, I love the science fiction tropes. I love that style of writing, but it's, much more interested in characters. And I thought this is just a great entryway into character relationships and how those change over time. So I was like, that's what I'm going to do next. That's what I've been working on. And it's tricky. It's a puzzle box. Time travel is a tricky thing.
Yeah. Set in Pittsburgh, too, for the next one?
The next one is set in Pittsburgh is referenced. It's set mostly in southwestern Pennsylvania around Cannonsburg and then through West Virginia. So I'm kind of going a little bit southern just to switch up the locales a little bit. But I think the next book after that is going to be back to home base.
That was Morning Edition host Josh Rollerson speaking with Pittsburgh-based writer and librarian Thomas Sweterlich. We've spent today's Essential Pittsburgh looking back on some of our favorite author interviews from 2014. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening. And from all of us at 90.5 WESA, Happy New Year.